From New York, this is Democracy Now!
There's about 1,500 lobbyists working for fossil fuel companies in the US. They're also working for some of the most progressive institutions in America, top universities, city governments, museums, art galleries, green groups, you name it. They're working for them. They have shared lobbyists.
The past 3 days have been the hottest on Earth, some say in 100,000 years. We'll speak with Guardian reporter Oliver Millman about double agents. Fossil fuel lobbyists work for U.S. groups trying to fight climate crisis. And we'll talk to Bill McKibben, who says the sun that's cooking us could cool us, too. Then to Guatemala, where election officials have rejected an attempt by the ruling business and political elite to overturn results from the first round of a presidential election, where the progressive anti-corruption candidate came in second and will now be in the race, a runoff.
We will fight corruption, because if we do not fight corruption, we will not achieve development and fight poverty.
We'll go to Guatemala City for the latest. And we'll speak with author Shadi Hamid about lessons for the next Arab Spring.
I argue in the piece that the Obama administration gave what amounted to a green light to General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to proceed with the military coup of July 3rd, 2013. And we are marking this week the 10th anniversary of that coup, which in some ways marks the end of the Arab Spring as we know it.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The world's average surface temperature has soared to its highest level ever recorded, surpassing record levels of heat measured just a day earlier and the day before that. This week's string of record-shattering hottest days came as climate scientists warned last month was the hottest June ever recorded, with 2023 on track to become the hottest year in human history. Meanwhile, a new report in the journal Nature Communications warns changing weather patterns and extreme heat due to the climate crisis will exacerbate the global food crisis, with lower crop yields anticipated in the near future. We'll have more on the climate crisis after headlines with Guardian reporter Oliver Millman and environmentalist Bill McKibben. In the United Kingdom, members of the climate action group Extinction Rebellion shut down operations at the nation's largest coal mine Wednesday in a nonviolent civil disobedience action. The open pit mine in South Wales had been operating without a license. Elsewhere in the UK, climate protesters disrupted play at the Wimbledon tennis tournament twice Wednesday, throwing orange confetti on the court and displaying T-shirts reading, "Just Stop Oil." On Thursday, youth climate activists disrupted a speech by UK Labour Party leader Keir Starmer, accusing him of U-turning on his pledge to fund a transition away from fossil fuels.
Young people want action.
Which side are the Labour Party on?
We are on the side of economic growth. Will you just let me please get on with this? Thank you very much.
Stop making U-turns here.
We have already... Will you just let me finish this and I'll come and talk to you about it? No, thank you very much.
We've tried to speak to you about it, but you haven't replied to us, Keir.
Look,
we need a Green New Deal right now.
In Sweden, Greta Thunberg and other youth climate activists have been charged with disobeying the police for peacefully blocking oil tankers at a port in Malmo last month. If convicted, the protesters face fines and up to 6 months in prison. The Biden administration is announcing it will ship cluster munitions to Ukraine as part of a Pentagon military aid package. The weapons are banned under the Convention on Cluster Munitions, an international treaty signed by more than 120 countries, though not by Russia, Ukraine, or the United States. Investigators with Human Rights Watch have documented how cluster bombs used by Russia and Ukraine have repeatedly killed and injured civilians. The group warns unexploded bomblets left behind after cluster attacks will continue to pose a risk to civilians for years to come. Former senior U.S. national security officials have held secret talks with prominent Russians believed to be close to the Kremlin with the aim of laying the groundwork for negotiations to end the war in Ukraine. That's according to a report by NBC News citing half a dozen unnamed sources who were reportedly briefed on the discussions. The State Department said the Biden administration did not sanction the discussions and denied encouraging them. Israel's military fired artillery shells on a pair of villages in southern Lebanon Thursday after two missiles were fired toward Israel. There have been no reports of injuries in the exchange of fire, which came after Israel carried out one of its largest military operations in decades in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. An Israeli court has acquitted a police officer over the shooting death of an unarmed, autistic Palestinian man in occupied East Jerusalem. Iyad El-Halak was a 32-year-old special needs student who attended and worked at a school near where he was shot dead in Jerusalem's Old City. His killing in May 2020 drew comparisons to the police killing of George Floyd in the United States. On Thursday, a judge threw out the charges against the officer, whose name was not made public, calling the killing an honest mistake. Iyad's mother, Rana Al-Hayek, said family was surprised by the ruling.
It's injustice. I never saw injustice like this against a young man like my son. My son is buried in the cemetery, and the killer is free and can travel around.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers shot and killed at least two Palestinian men during an early morning raid today in the city of Nablus. At least three Palestinians were wounded in the assault. Separately, Israeli forces chased down and killed a Palestinian man after he allegedly shot and killed a soldier protecting an illegal settlement near Nablus. At the United Nations, Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the massive two-day assault on Jenin by Israel earlier this week that killed at least 12 Palestinians and left more than 100 injured. Guterres called Israel's airstrikes during the raid inconsistent with the conduct of law enforcement operations and said that as the occupying power, Israel has responsibility to ensure that the civilian population is protected. Members of the UN Security Council, including the United States, have voiced support for deploying a multinational armed force to Haiti. Thursday's meeting follows a trip to Haiti by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who appealed for the international community to act now on Haiti.
Predatory gangs are using kidnappings and sexual violence as weapons to terrorize entire communities. And I've heard appalling accounts of women and girls being gang-raped and of people being burned alive. We are not calling for a military or political mission of the United Nations. We are calling for a robust security force deployed by member states to work hand in hand with the Haitian National Police to defeat and dismantle the gangs and restore security across the country.
Haitian officials have requested the international force, but many in Haiti have opposed such a presence due to the disastrous history of UN and foreign interventions in Haiti. This all comes as Haiti today marks 2 years since the assassination of the Haitian President Moïse. A Haitian government watchdog released a letter yesterday slamming the lack of accountability and the stalled investigation of the killing, reinforcing a culture of impunity and corruption that's endangered all Haitians. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is in Beijing for a four-day trip aimed at easing tensions between the U.S. and China. Yellen's meeting with the Chinese Premier Li Qiang today. Yellen has criticized China's punitive actions and obstacles imposed on U.S. companies, including export controls on minerals and denying market access. The U.S. has imposed its own restrictions on China, focusing on its technology trade with the U.S. This is Secretary Yellen.
The U.S. seeks healthy economic competition with China, but healthy economic competition where both sides benefit is only sustainable if that competition is fair.
Climate change envoy John Kerry is set to visit China next week to resume talks on the climate crisis. China and the U.S. are the world's two biggest polluters, as well as the two largest investors in clean energy. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved a drug to slow the cognitive decline of patients with mild dementia and other symptoms of early Alzheimer's disease. Approval of the intravenously administered drug Leqembi clears the way for Medicare and other health insurers to begin covering the extremely expensive treatment. The U.S. Geological Survey has found that nearly half the country's tap water likely contains at least one type of PFAS, also known as forever chemicals. PFAS are found in everyday products such as personal care items, clothing, cleaning products, as well as food. They've been linked to a host of environmental and health problems, including certain kinds of cancer. Studies have shown nearly all Americans have detectable levels of PFAS in their blood. Over 6,000 conservative congregations of the United Methodist Church, about one-fifth of the total number in the U.S., are preparing to leave the denomination over rifts about the role of the LGBTQIA people in the church. This comes amidst growing defiance of the church's policies prohibiting same-sex marriage and the ordination of LGBTQ people. More conservative members decided to launch the separate global Methodist church as states like Texas, Alabama, Kentucky, and Ohio have seen the largest number of departures. Progressive congregations are expected to propose new church laws that allow same-sex marriage and the ordination of LGBTQ people in 2024. And Nepal's Supreme Court has issued a temporary order greenlighting the registration of same-sex marriages for the first time. LGBTQIA activists and couples across Nepal celebrated the decision.
So far, we are very happy. If it becomes permanent, we will be even happier.
We hope the permanent marriage regulation order will come as soon as possible. Things for us will be the same as for other men and women. That would be ideal.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The world's average surface temperature has soared to its highest level ever recorded, surpassing record levels of heat measured just one day earlier and the day before that. This week's string of record-shattering hottest days came as climate scientists warned last month was the hottest June ever recorded, with 2023 on track to become the hottest year in human history. Meanwhile, a new report in the journal Nature Communications warns changing weather patterns and extreme heat due to the climate crisis will exacerbate the global food crisis, with lower crop yields anticipated in the near future. All of this has added new urgency for broad government action to address the climate crisis, but much of it has been thwarted by fossil fuel lobbyists, which we'll talk more about in a minute with The Guardian reporter Oliver Millman. But we begin with author and environmentalist Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org and founder of the organization Third Act, whose new Substack piece is headlined, "No Human Has Ever Seen It Hotter, But the Sun That's Cooking Us Could Cool Us Too." His latest piece for The New Yorker is headlined, "To Save the Planet, Should We Really Be Moving Slower? The Degrowth Movement Makes a Comeback." Bill, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. So the three hottest days in human history, some say in 100,000 years. Talk about what's happening and what needs to happen.
Well, good morning, Amy. On the one hand, there's nothing surprising about what's happening. It's what you and I have been talking about for literally decades now. Scientists have told us that this, as we pour carbon into the atmosphere, is the inevitable result. But we are seeing in 2023 that result come to the fore. We've seen truly startling things. It's now a reasonable chance that this will turn out to be the hottest year ever recorded. We've already had, as you say, the hottest days, the hottest week. We just had the hottest June. If you think it's bad here, really have some place in your heart for the people living in spots that are beyond hot and unlikely to be air-conditioned. Last night in parts of Algeria, cities in Algeria, the nighttime temperature stayed above 103 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the hottest nighttime minimums ever recorded in Africa. So all around the world, we're seeing remarkable, remarkable things going on. And this is just as the El Nino Pacific warming begins to kick into gear. The next 18 months are going to be a time of chaos and havoc as we go to temperatures that no human has ever seen, no society and no infrastructure has ever endured. We don't know precisely what will happen, but we can predict that it's going to be very, very hard. And we can predict really, too, I think, that this is the last of these moments we're going to have when the world is summoned to action by events and when there's still time to make at least some difference in the question of how hot it ultimately gets.
Can you talk about the degrowth movement, Bill?
Well, as you know, there's some ever since the limits to growth in 1972, I guess, there's been this critique that the world can't keep growing as it has been, that it'll eventually lead to ecological collapse that eventually seems to be coming true. But it is a very strange moment because, on the other hand, we understand that we need to increase very, very quickly the amount of green energy and clean energy that we're producing. And that requires growing at least one thing: solar panels, wind turbines, batteries, so on. So my piece for The New Yorker was an attempt to square that circle, to say, are there ways that we could use this moment of extraordinary need for technological change to also produce some social change along the way, to build a different kind of world? We need to make the technological change. And I think we also need to make some really serious social change as we do it towards a different kind of planet. The good news is that we're beginning to see the payoff from some of that technological change. You know, Texas was the center of the heat wave in the U.S. so far this year. This heat dome settled over Texas, and the numbers were astounding. There were cities setting new high temperature records 10 days in a row. But the grid did not collapse in Texas, and it did not collapse, one analyst after another is telling us, because of there's a lot of solar power on that grid, four times more than there was in just 4 or 5 years ago. And that power, not surprisingly, solar panels do well in heat waves. That power has been enough to keep Texas going. Of course, and as Oliver will make the case in a minute, the irony is that the Texas legislature is busy trying to help the fossil fuel industry and close down its renewable industry. But so far, it's renewables that are doing the job there. And believe me, utilities around the country are starting to watch because they understand that not only is this power cheap, it's truly critical in the world that we're headed into now.
I mean, we've been getting reports of hikers and tourists who've died of the heat. A woman died in Arizona's Grand Canyon National Park after falling unconscious during an 8-mile hike in over 100-degree Fahrenheit weather. A man found dead in car with two flat tires, Death Valley National Park. I think the recorded temperature the day before was like 126 degrees. You had a teen and his dad in Texas. But what about workers around the world as well?
Well, I mean, the scale of what we're doing is astonishing. And you're very right to point that out. One of the things that the International Labor Organization has told us is that our ability to do work outdoors is already something like 10% degraded, and that it'll be 30%, 40% by mid-century. That is the number of hours that people can be out working. There are lots of reports. China's just coming through an extraordinary heat wave, and Mexico has been through a heat wave that makes the one in Texas look small by comparison. People waking up agricultural laborers waking up at 4 a.m. to get done what they can before it gets too hot to be outside. We're changing the world in deeply fundamental ways. We're not going to be able to stop. We can't stop global warming at this point. All we can do is try to stop it short of the place where it cuts civilizations off at the knees. And that will require nimbleness and speed that we've really never seen before. As you know, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has told us we need to cut emissions in half by 2030 to have any chance of meeting those targets that you reported on in Paris just 8 years ago. By my watch, 2030 is 6 years and 5 months away. So The need to move fast has never been clearer, I think.
Bill McKibben, does expanding renewable energy necessarily lead to a reduction in fossil fuels? Recent data show fossil fuels accounted for 82% of worldwide energy supply last year, even as record wind and solar came online.
We're going to find out in the next couple of years, and it has to. Renewable energy is right now at this takeoff point. It's suddenly becoming substantial, and it has to reduce fossil fuel use if it's to matter. That's why people were so upset when President Biden, who's done so much to sponsor renewable energy, also started approving things like the Willow Oil Project in Alaska or the MVP pipeline in Appalachia or this new string of LNG ports along the Gulf Coast. The politicians are getting better at saying yes to renewable energy, but they're no better at saying no to fossil fuel than they were before. And that's because of the extraordinary political power of that industry. They're clearly willing to break the planet. It's why we need more activists and more people out pushing. At Third Act, for instance, we're training up thousands of people to take on the public utility commissions in state after state after state. These are incredibly important institutions, the public utility commissions. They set rates and help determine what facilities the utilities are allowed to build, but they're traditionally been protected by their incredible boringness, and they've been captured in almost every case by the utilities that they're supposed to regulate. So we need lots of people out pushing in places like that, as well as out in the streets or at Wimbledon or wherever it is. If you're an older person like me, come join us at Third Act and see what we can do.
Finally, Bill, it's beautiful to hear the birds singing behind you in Middlebury, Vermont. Can you talk about the effect of this global heat wave, the hottest Earth ever, on the flora and fauna of the world?
It comes at the worst possible time. We already know that because of lots of things, climate change, but also habitat destruction and pesticides and things, the number of animals on this planet is something like 70% lower than it was when I was born. And now we're being pushed and pushed and pushed. I think in the next few weeks, we're going to see devastating reports from around, especially the oceans of the planet. It looks like something like 40% of the Earth's seas are now going through what the oceanographers call marine heat waves. That means widespread bleaching of coral. We forget sometimes we call the planet Earth, but if we were being honest, we'd probably call it ocean, because that's 70% of the planet's surface. And the damage there is extraordinary. Sea temperatures are not just a little bit higher than they've ever been before. They're not off the charts. They're off the wall. The chart is tacked too. So it's going to be a brutal period, not just for human beings. And that brutality is going to increase unless we get our act together now.
Bill McKibben, thanks so much for being with us, co-founder of 350.org, founder of Third Act. We'll link to your Substack piece, No Human Has Ever Seen It Hotter, But the Sun That's Cooking Us Could Cool Us Too, and your New Yorker piece, To Save the Planet, Should We Really Be Moving Slower? The Degrowth Movement Makes a Comeback. Double agents. Fossil fuel lobbyists work for U.S. groups trying to fight climate crisis. That's the title of a damning new investigation by The Guardian that reveals how more than 1,500 lobbyists are working for fossil fuel companies at the same time they're representing hundreds of cities, universities, big tech companies, and even environmental groups that claim they're taking steps to address the climate crisis. The report is based on a new database by the group F-Minus that was published online this week. For more, we're joined by The Guardian's environmental reporter, Oliver Millman, who is also author of the book, The Insect Crisis. Oliver, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain what you found and this contradiction of fossil fuel lobbyists representing the fossil fuel companies, but also, for example, environmental groups.
Hi there, Amy. Good to be with you. Yes, as you mentioned, there are about 1,500 at least lobbyists across the US who do state-level lobbying for fossil fuel companies such as Exxon, Shell, BP, and so on. But they also work for some of the most progressive-minded institutions in the country, you know, not only kind of cities such as Los Angeles, Philadelphia, even Baltimore, which is a city that is suing big oil because of its climate damages. Baltimore shares a lobbyist with Exxon, which is one of the defendants in that case, quite extraordinarily. But also a range of other institutions, museums, art galleries, a new museum in New York, the Los Angeles County Art Museum in LA, big tech, the kind of big tech companies that have said they will do so much to address the climate crisis, Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, all share lobbyists with big oil. Apple shares a lobbyist with the Coke Industries Network, that group of companies that has done so much to delay and deny the science of climate change, as well as stymie action to kind of cut emissions. And there's also more than 150 universities that share lobbyists with big oil and gas, including many universities that have divested themselves from fossil fuels, which is an effort that Bill, who was speaking before, has helped kind of spearhead. There's universities such as University of Washington, Syracuse University, California State University, that have all looked to divest themselves of fossil fuels and yet have lobbyists who work on other days of the week on pushing fossil fuel interests. So this is the extraordinary kind of overlap.
So just to be very clear, Oliver, you have a guy lobbying at the state level, one day saying you got to deregulate for Exxon, because I represent Exxon, he says, and the next day saying you got to shut down these fossil fuel companies because he represents an environmental group. Same guy.
That's pretty much it. I mean, this data set doesn't show exactly what these lobbyists are lobbying on in terms of particular topics, but we know who their clients are and we know where the overlaps are. So yes, you work for Exxon on Monday to kind of push the interests of Exxon to keep drilling for oil and gas. And then on Tuesday, you're working for the city of Baltimore that's suing Exxon for damages.
Let's talk about Baltimore. In the state of Maryland, F-Minus reveals, as you said, many nonprofit groups, municipal county governments are sharing lobbyists with the fossil fuel industry, including Baltimore and Johns Hopkins University, one of the leading institutions in the research of climate change. The database reveals, quote, the trustees of Johns Hopkins voted to divest from coal in December 2017, stating a public and explicit stance will help propel the weight of public opinion toward accelerating the transition away from coal as a source of electric power around the globe. Despite this stance, lobbyist listings for 2022-23 show Johns Hopkins sharing one or more Maryland lobbyists with two companies with substantial coal interests, NRG Energy and Wholesome Participation, if that's how it's pronounced, in addition to five companies with upstream and midstream oil and gas operations. And in Florida, the Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital shared a lobbyist with coal plant operator Teco Energy. If you can go more into that, and also a point you make in the piece is that they are then sharing the strategy, say, of an environmental group or a university that's just divested, with the oil companies, because they represent one on Monday and the other on Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great danger. I mean, one of the justifications of this is that, well, you know, you want the best lobbyists if you're a particular institution, including even an environmental group. And there are several environmental groups that share lobbyists with big oil. A bit like a lawyer, you could be a lawyer that represents, you know, Donald Trump on one day and Planned Parenthood on another day. And you have this kind of professionalism that means that you'd have a divide on that. But the practical nature of that, of this, is, of course, is that there's this sensitive information you don't really want to be shared with the other side, particularly if you're actively campaigning against the other side or suing them in court, as several cities are. So there is that danger of a conflict of interest there. And as you mentioned with Johns Hopkins, there is this slightly opaque nature of divestment from many universities where they said that they will rid their endowments of fossil fuels, and yet students have been pushing for kind of greater details and clarity about what that means in terms of distance themselves from fossil fuel industry at large. And I spoke to several kind of student groups who have said they're very disheartened that their universities are continuing to work with